Fragpod Academy. This is a recording of the launch of the third edition of Beyond the Fragments in May 2013. When it was first published in 1979, Beyond the Fragments caused something of a sensation. Its authors, Sheila Rowbottom, Lynn Siegel and Hilary Wainwright, were all part of the women's liberation movement, concerned about the fragmentation and sectarianism within the socialist and feminist movements, arguing that they should learn from each other and move forward together. The event was hosted by the Institute for Social Research at Birkbeck University of London. In her introduction, Sasha Rosenneil, director of the Institute, talked about Beyond the Fragments as a very influential book, the type that the Institute was set up to talk about, think about and explore. The chair for the evening was journalist and author Melissa Benn, who first of all introduces Sheila Rowbottom.
Sheila is an author of many books. You are a fellow of Manchester, not fellow, you're an
honorary fellow.
Honorary fellow at Manchester and Bristol, and I don't really think she needs that. Thank you very much.
Well, we've been hearing an awful lot about scrounges since the recession set in. It's been scrounges, scrounges, scrounges. Funny, isn't it, how scrounges, they're always poor people, and rich people somehow are deserving. Scrounges have joined the workers who went on strike in the winter of discontent in the late 1970s when the first version of Beyond the Fragments came out. It's always a puzzle to me when I hear car workers, grave diggers, public sector workers, many of whom are low-paid women, being called greedy by pundits who are earning vastly more than any of those people ever did in the 1970s. And the response that they were having was to inflation, which was eating away at their pay. They joined the strikes which followed a financial crisis, and I think that the echoes are familiar. Remember the bogeyman. The other night I went to a meeting in, as it happens, the Tony Benn Hall in Bristol on blacklisting now, and electricians, bricklayers, woodworkers, transport workers talked about being barred from jobs if they raised dangers at work and dangers to the public. They described an atmosphere of fear. One said anyone who is an active trade unionist in the private sector nowadays is a very brave person. They were grim but still resisting, and they were, unfortunately, a minority. Many people have come to see this gangster-like capitalism we live in as inevitable. Yesterday, I was walking around in Covent Garden. I was slightly playing truant, actually, from getting this together. And I heard two shop assistants discussing a car that was parked in Longacre without a permit. It was red and gleaming, and it looked as if it was about to take off into space. The young woman thought it was wrong, but the young man explained, "You have a Ferrari, you park where you like." And there was no trace of irony. This gangster capitalism's appeal is the possibility of freedom and respect, even though few actually achieve it. The problem is how to challenge it. And when we wrote Beyond the Fragments, we were preoccupied with the process of organising for change. As Melissa said, we took a whole load of things for granted, which we can no longer take for granted. We still had a word for what we wanted, socialism, though we saw this not as dogma, but as something which could be renewed and recreated through the understandings of the new movements. And we were part of one of those movements, Women's Liberation, and we hoped that other people in other groups would come to give their experiences to create a new universality out of the particulars that we had known. Well, I still identify with the word socialism, but I realise others no longer do. So I'll say that I'm talking about beyond the beyond. I see that as the collective, cooperative, associative, social vision, which has been so vital and still is. But I don't think that that is sufficient. The social movements brought other equally vital insights. The need to change how human beings can relate and perceive one another. The necessity of releasing the potential for the full expression of the individuality of everyone. Of course, these were present within the socialist tradition, but they've become buried and grown muffled. To us, they were essential even for us to begin. Such a transformation requires a profound challenge to the inequalities of our society, which we've actually accentuated since that time. The inequalities of 2013 are manifest in exploitation and in the possession of things, but also in access to the means of life, fresh air, beauty, an unpolluted environment, leisure, ideas, communication, and less tangibly about how people are regarded and how people experience themselves. If we are to change our society, I think we have to go beyond specific identities, beyond the left, beyond even the have-nots. We have to convince people who have bought into those aspirations of freedom and respect, locks up in inequality and individualism, and I think individualism is different from individuality. We have to expose the selfishness which has been encouraged and enhanced since the late 1970s as a con, as unjust, as destructive of human happiness, as wasteful, ugly, short-term, and the perpetuator of fear, the kind of fear that the people at the meeting are talking about in their work. Loathsome fear, mistrust and smarm. I've invented that word instead of smarmy, smarm. We have to connect to the unease and dissatisfaction many people who do not see themselves as on the left feel in their daily lives, and create with them a movement and a power that goes beyond protest. Beyond the beyond could be so much better.
Lynn Siegel, again, needs no introduction, but I'm going to give one to her, for her, teaches in the psychosocial studies department of Birkbeck and has been involved in and reflected upon feminist and left politics for decades, watching as some things get better and much worse. She campaigns for peace in Israel, Palestine, and coming out as old, has just completed a book on ageing to appear in the autumn. Lynn.
Thank you, Melissa, and wonderful to see you all here. I was always good at titles, Sheila once joked. She was and is, and that helped launch Beyond the Fragments. People liked the title, and even the subtitle. Or some did, given its timing, and suggesting we might try just a little harder to unite in the face of what Stuart Hall dubbed the great moving right show. As it turned out, not everybody on the left, or in the women's movement and other social movements, were willing or felt able to try to unite across their differences. While some in the left groups rejected the importance we attach to direct action and autonomy and despised our lack of party discipline, thinking it necessary for them to control any form of coalition building. Sadly, though, I've no time here to address the rise and fall of the various attempts over the last 34 years to build coalitions of resistance to the rise and rise of the right. Things fall apart for many reasons. Sectarian squabbling, marginalisation, exhaustion, most often, however, simply through defeat, after defeat, which happened over the long years of Tory rule, as Thatcher carefully manoeuvred her forces, directly and indirectly, to crush all sites of protest. Directly abolishing the GLC, indirectly allowing manufacturing to decline, selling off public housing, squeezing welfare, with the underlying aim of giving giving a free rein to corporate capital and the city. Markets know best, that was her mantra at all times. Promoting corporate capital's increasing stranglehold on nation states and, ironically, in the end, on any real notion of the free market itself. Nobody nowadays can easily compete with the price fixing, and other ways in which corporate capital can undermine any form of democracy, hollowing out the democracy which we've all tried to work to preserve. The result, poverty doubled, unemployment tripled, social mobility declined, and inequality soared. With such defeats, pessimism grew, and as well, with economic survival now more precarious for so many, the social networks once sustaining progressive practice throughout the 1970s also withered. So I just want to briefly mention two things: the triumph of Thatcherism and the unbroken rise of corporate capital or neoliberalism, and also the possibilities, again, for building a new consensus and the role of feminism within this. As Thatcher herself made clear, she was involved in both an economic and an ideological project. Economics are the method, she said in 1981. The object is to change hearts and souls. And that was really what she spent a lot of her time doing. With luck, shrewdness, and the backing of corporate capital, whose interests she unswervingly served, plus the tireless assistance of the Tory press, Murdoch and Dacre in particular, The Sun and The Mail, she did have considerable success. Their shared crusade was to roll back all the hard-won gains of the post-45 state, and some of you may have seen the film about that, where we can see exactly what she has managed to do, And she managed to do it in creating a new consensus, or not a complete consensus, but a new escalation of a type of approach to the excoriation of all that those of us here valued through the manipulation of fear, anxiety and hostility, as Sheila described. Fear of economic decline, exaggerating the effects of inflation, fear of foreigners, hostility to those on benefits, routinely depicted as scroungers, as Sheila said. Above all, fear of weakness, now packaged as pathologies, the pathologies of dependency on the nanny state, lack of discipline, non-competitiveness. Britain had to be stronger and more competitive, the place where the entrepreneurial could get rich, vastly richer. And people would be taught not to care about the fallout, to hate vulnerability and weakness, and to deny our own weakness. This is why she relished being called the Iron Lady, and why she eagerly marched Britain off into war in the Falklands and urged George Bush on to start, George Bush Sr., to start bombing Iraq. True, Thatcher never did win a majority and aroused as much visceral hatred as veneration. The wicked witch is dead. Rejoice, many celebrated 2 weeks ago. I didn't. Yet it seems to me hatred, as well as submissive veneration of the fantasized strong leader, savior or devil, especially a strong female one easily sliding into misogyny, can understand, can undermine useful and creative thought. Thatcher did help consolidate the new consensus that many signed up to. Look at UKIP today. They're still there, signed up to it. Which is why Thatcherism long survived Thatcher. She could never have done that alone. She had a lot of people supporting her. Her politics further divided the working class and people generally, inciting the increasingly less well-off against the even more vulnerable immigrants, claimants, gays, all those declared un-British for resisting her, trade unionists in particular, the enemy within. But feminism too, 70s egalitarian feminism, quite as much as the old welfare consensus, was also anathema to Thatcher, with our demands for both more welfare and reform and democratic accountability of welfare. Feminists hate me, and I don't blame them, for I hate feminism. It is poison, she said to her advisor, Paul Johnson. These were the populist divisions that Thatcher and the New Right worked to incite. Strong against work, weak, employed against unemployed, authority against permissiveness, Britain against the rest of the world apart from the USA, in order to retain the myth of Britain's continuing preeminence in a world we no longer ruled. Coming to power, New Labour was frightened to tackle much of her legacy, and the 13 years of them in power did so little to reverse the victories of the right under Thatcher, least of all ideologically, remaining silent on how little welfare fraud there actually is compared to those being denied the benefits they're entitled to, running scared of immigration issues, scarier than ever today, silent also on how rarely immigrants gain access to housing or other benefits, how much they contribute to the UK economy. Worst of all, they accepted Thatcher's deregulation of finance capital, opening up the city to the influx of international capital, feeding the speculative frenzy that would amass the vast quantities of debt and finally trigger the global meltdown of 2008, creating the crisis we're all in. Yet still, after all these years, the tabloids blast out Thatcher's falsehoods, allowing the Tory coalition to pretend that it was Labour's welfare policy, not market greed and recklessness, that caused this economic crisis. Thus, though Thatcher's economic legacy has failed catastrophically, her tactics of privatisation, cuts and contempt for the poor are pursued even more forcefully than ever. We have nothing to rejoice about in her death. So it's damn hard, of course, to overturn the orchestration of opinion pitting the powerless against the even more vulnerable. It's such an old story. But we know there is resistance. Indeed, we know it's been breaking out everywhere recently, from the Arab Spring to street protests in southern Europe, Occupy campaigns globally, and right here, right now, as we'll hear, there is growing opposition to the brutalities of austerity, both in the UK and, of course, even more fiercely in southern Europe, which we need to link up with. As well, feminism is on the rise again, along with the continuing endemic, indeed growing violence and sexual abuse of women around the globe, alongside the ways in which austerity measures are hitting many women hardest. All this has provoked more women into starting to talk about how they can resist. Thus, from east to west, south to north, there have been upsurges of the unemployed, slum dwellers, trade unionists, green activists, and more, alongside feminists, all demanding a fairer share of their country's resources beyond restrictions of class, gender, race, sexuality. But to succeed now, even more than 40 years ago, these modes of resistance have to manage to reach out beyond the heat of action to build movements and coalitions that can survive and somehow have impact on those trying to influence government policies before fragmentation and exhaustion again take their toll on rebellious spirits. How can democracy in action be preserved to form coherent, forceful, and intelligible opposition to corporate capital with all its might, and to the wars, inequalities, and oppression that it both produces and or tolerates? If we actually believe in the possibility of a peaceful and fairer distribution of the world's resources and less environmentally polluting uses of them to preserve the possibility of any sustainable future, protests must somehow, some of the time, cohere into something more enduringly able to keep pushing for change, attempting to influence those who are in or might be able to form a future government, or in some way bring us closer to the levers of power. Can it be done? New Labour's failure to reverse most of Thatcher's policies, not to mention invading Iraq, supporting the US invading Iraq, have reinforced contempt for party politics. Moreover, if we add in the knowledge we have of the effects of climate change and imminent water and food deprivation around the globe, it becomes harder to know whether fear of our possible futures will strengthen or weaken the seeds of hope the left requires to nurture belief in its democratic and egalitarian goals. Fascism is on the rise alongside resistance in southern Europe, particularly in Greece. It's always so easy to turn the vulnerable against each other. The greater the levels of inequality between people, the easier this is to accomplish. And this happens not only in the rhetoric of the right, or UKIP, turning potential allies into opponents, but in our own ranks as well, around those who are close to us. So if we hope to see any sort of new and more vibrant left again, we need to see the interconnectedness of all of us who are struggling for more democratic and egalitarian ends and sustainable ecological goals. This means cherishing our different forms of resistance to the heedless hegemony of contemporary corporate capital and to the pollution that inevitably comes along in its wake. But one thing I would stress about forms of resistance is that, in my view, the old anti-statism of some of the left is far too closely attuned to the dominant refrains of neoliberalism, promising to get government off our backs to be useful. People are shaking their heads already. We have to keep fighting for at least some notion of the caring, redistributive state that Thatcher and this current government were and are determined to destroy. In the UK, with our still unchanged electoral system, this means once more trying to strengthen left Labour, whether inside or outside the party, and perhaps also left forces within the Green Party, which try to operate in coalition with Labour, working for a safer environment alongside a more egalitarian and peaceful world. Different strategies are possible and the most effective hard to gauge. But in my view, the lessons from that 70s feminist poison that Thatcher so despised, premised upon equality and democratized resources, concerned with the quality of care, education, culture, personal welfare, the sharing of skills and imagination, while noting our interdependence and cherishing autonomy and personal life. Thinking about all those things seems to me something that we have to take into any new coalitions or solidarity actions that we're engaged in. Thinking that it's only together and never alone that we can build anything like the sort of world that we want. The Daily Telegraph was quick to announce on Thatcher's death that she was the ultimate feminist icon. And the maverick writer, Lionel Shriver, also applauded Thatcher's muscular feminism. Let's show them how wrong they are by offering something different.
Thank you. you, Lynn. Now, the next speaker is Hilary Wainwright, who is, among many other things, the co-editor of Red Pepper, a fellow of the Transnational Institute, a writer and researcher on new forms of political and social movements, and, relevant to what Lynn has said, the author of Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy.
Coming back after 2 months away, immersed in working in Brazil, it's been very exciting to find signs of movements and activists converging, working out ways of strengthening scattered resistance, scattered but growing, and combining forces behind promoting thoughtful alternatives, both national initiatives like the People's Assembly or the Kilburn Manifesto or Ken Loach's initiative to open debate about a left party, or initiatives coming out of specific campaigns like the Camp to Reclaim Power outside the West Burton Power Station in Nottingham, which is linking climate change to struggles against authority and to rethinking power, or the linking up of local struggles with the fury against, quite rightly, fury against the bedroom tax, driving people to link up across the country and with others around welfare and housing. Even the response tonight, which was intended as quite a demure sort of book launch, is a sign of this desire to create an outspoken and self-confident opposition. So I feel like Lynn and Sheila, and maybe everybody here, in one sense a sense of excitement, but in another sense a more sombre awareness, both of the context that Lynn so vividly described about the rise of the right, the impact of UKIP and all this. But an awareness that until now we failed, in spite of often very exciting moments, you know, the Beyond the Fragments conference, the socialist movement conference, all these different sort of exciting beginnings, and one can see more now. We failed to find appropriate ways to combine in a sustained and thoughtful way really powerful means of bringing together or connecting all the dissent that there is to neoliberal inhumanity and the widely shared desire for social justice and a truly egalitarian and emancipatory alternative. I think I'm also sort of starting from both agreeing very much with Sheila about with Lynn, rather than going like mentioning it, nothing
between the two of them.
We used to get letters to Sheila Wainwright. Anyway, but starting from this recognition of both the death of Thatcher, yet the persistence of Thatcherism, it reminds me that we've been victims of a raised earth policy, that Thatcherism tried to destroy all traces of an alternative, a bit like a killer covering his tracks. And New Labour then carried on the story, as it were, was complicit. And so we have this all-pervasive myth, which was reflected in eulogies after Thatcher's death by all the political leaders, that were kind of in awe of her ability to drive change. Apart from the destruction that she wrought, she blocked change. There was change already beginning of a completely different kind. There was a process of democratising the state rather than privatising it, of restructuring manufacturing industry for socially useful purposes rather than destroying it, of developing the new technology for socially created purposes rather than as an instrument of new forms of management and state control. So anyone here over 60, and I guess there are a few, however young we are at heart, know that the idea that there was no alternative is a lie, a deeply embedded lie, an almost institutional lie. We were working on alternatives in practice as much as in theory, and we witnessed the destruction by Thatcher of what Norman Tebbit rightly called the modern socialism, and he added, "We will kill it," when he was describing the GLC. That memory of an alternative was then effectively deleted from historical memory by Tony Blair. What I want to do in my 10 minutes, as a sort of a reassertion of the fact there is an alternative, is to focus on a fundamental dimension of the diverse and democratic alternatives, because it was very plural, that was emerging in the 70s and early 80s, fundamental to the potential for alternatives to the command economy. On the one hand, they have a choice between the command economy and the so-called free, but in fact corporate-dominated market. And this really concerns the understanding of knowledge, the understanding of the production of knowledge, of what counts as knowledge, of whose knowledge matters, and an understanding of knowledge which is fundamental both to our vision and to our ways of organising and interconnecting the means with the ends, prefiguring the means and the ends, and also to our understanding of the fusion between self-change and social change. What we were witnessing, I think, from the 60s is a sort of dethroning of knowledge from the throne of authority, which in a sense meant that instead of looking up to authority as a source of knowledge, we started looking across, looking to ourselves, looking to each other, looking outwards, eclectically, creatively, developing collective capacity. And I noticed what led this in a way was one of the main kind of reasons that drove me to become involved in Beyond the Fragments. Because at that time, I was noticing a common feature of all the movements I was part of, or close to them. I'm not going to be nostalgic here, because what I'm trying to say here is about a resource and a way of thinking that I think has been deleted from history and is crucial to our rethinking at the left now and developing a confident alternative now. Because what seemed to be common to the movements I was part of in the 70s was that they were all organised in ways that made possible the production of knowledge, knowledge essential to their struggles, to defining their vision, to their distinctive powers, movements, to this idea of self-realisation as essential to political change. So just three examples that were important to me and I think have lessons for today. Firstly, then the importance of consciousness-raising groups in the women's movement for the development of policies, consciousness, the fusion of self-change and social change, the way we recognise knowledge that was embedded in emotion, daily experience, conventionally dismissed as knowledge. We recognise that as vital and profound as a source of knowledge to be creatively combined with other sources, historical, scientific, to produce policies and ways of organising around health, around social policies, education, the confronting of violence against women. In other words, a source of a political vision of alternative policies that met women's needs. Then there was, on the other hand, the way I was working with shop stewards in the engineering industry at the time, and they were facing closures and redundancies. And the way they responded was both resistance but also insistence that they had an alternative that wasn't just about documents and policies and kind of industrial strategies drawn up on a purely sort of academic or traditional policy basis, but alternatives that drew on and valued the knowledge, what Mike Cooley, one of them in Lucas Aerospace, called the tacit knowledge, of those that were actually producing, that were at the heart of the manufacturing industry at that time. And in a way, sitting at those meetings that were pretty male-dominated, but the kind of language, the way people related to each other, the way they valued each other's practical knowledge seemed sort of to echo things I'd experienced in the women's movement. And then a third experience was with tenants' organisations, working with council workers responsible for the repairs, working together to try and improve the ability of the council to respond to tenants' needs and desires, linking with alliances in Wales and Sheffield and elsewhere. I was in Tyneside at the time. To develop a whole strategy for public housing that directly answered Thatcher's attack and showed how public housing could be responsive both to individual needs, individual desires, and social needs. And it seemed to me that what we had here was a kind of notion of social organisation, political organisation, industrial trade union organisation, that was not so much about unity and discipline, or at least that was in a way subordinate to a more ambitious notion of organisation, which had the goal of fully realising the capacities of all, which took that notion of Marx, the fulfilment of each being a condition for the fulfilment of all, not just as a matter of a vision of an alternative socialist society, but essential to how we worked towards socialism. It seems to me that kind of understanding was not evident in the traditional organisations of the left, who saw knowledge in a much more centralised, sort of expert-dominated way. To me, it's implied a completely different understanding of leadership. Leadership not as the fount of all authority, but in a way, sometimes the instigator of investigations, a kind of source of curiosity. For example, the leadership of the Ford workers' combine, who then, in the face of redundancies and the strategies of the corporation, would then seek to investigate the company, find out the links, the basis for organising across Europe, or those who investigated the links that connected the clothes in Marks and Spencer's with the homeworking in Mexico. The people who ensured that an organisation had learning built into its very bones, who always ensured that new people were welcome, that people were talked to about what was going on in their context. I remember academically puzzling over Michel's Iron Law of Oligarchy, which always seemed to me a complete put-down of the idea of social and political change, and then realising, I mean, maybe this is terribly obvious, but that its whole kind of basis was rested on the presumption of the inherent ignorance of the rank and file, that the idea that actually the mass of people were somehow incapable and that it was the leadership that had the expertise. And in a way, at the time of reflecting on that, I saw in the Labour Party the absolute outrage, the complete fury of the leadership of the Labour Party. The idea that the membership actually knew what to do, that the membership, you know, the idea that trade unionists, that workers had an alternative for industry, that they had an alternative for how the public sector could be reformed, and that then meant a very different kind of Labour Party, one in which the membership were really active, were producers of social change, were producers of politics. And therefore, you know, required MPs and so on who were truly accountable was treated as with absolute sort of abomination. I don't know. I'm getting on.
Well, you're getting on. So can you sort of, yeah.
Okay. I better move on quickly. So, but then also I found with the Workers' Party in Brazil in the 80s and 90s, again, that sort of, and here was an example of a party trying to build on a different theory of knowledge, the theory that then there in Brazil was reflected in the work of Paulo Freire, which understood the development of people's capacities as part of the realisation of their power and building a political organisation based on that. I'll just skip rather quickly. So what I suppose this leads to is firstly a thinking of, which I think is implicit in the movements, this important distinction between power as transformative capacity, which is implicit in this understanding of knowledge, of the capacity of people to be producers of social change, producers of politics, agents of economic change, and power as domination, and in a way, particularly obviously the domination of the state. And the left has traditionally been based around that idea of competing for the power of domination and using it to achieve socialism. And I suppose what's implicit in this understanding of knowledge is the idea that we do need, as Lynn says, we do need to get hold of the powers of domination, to use it against capital, to use it to protect and to support transformative power. And this is, for example, illustrated in Syriza, the party in Greece, that sees 80% of change as based in society, 20% through legislation and government. And that notion of the state, and I think therefore the notion of political organisation as a resource, seems key. But I better change, I better end. So we've got a hugely rich collective or connected intelligence here. And I think what I'd really be interested in people talking about is the forms of organisation that they experience being part of, not necessarily political in the sense of sort of dealing with government, but transformative. What forms of organisation, whether, you know, seeing organisation more in terms of a resource, a support, a platform, a means of connection, have they found important? And so I'll just end up with my own experience. My great friend and wonderful person, Paul Foote, would have ended his speech by saying, join the SWP. But I'm not going to say that. I'm not even going to say subscribe to Red Pepper. I'm going to say Red Pepper, which is a legacy of Beyond the Fragments and something that survived, is simply a resource, one of many resources that most of you have been involved in creating such resources. So please, you know, if you have unfinished thoughts from this discussion, then do feed them to a discussion that we'll have, hopefully, on the Red Pepper website, and hopefully we can be a resource for carrying on this discussion.
Well, thanks. I hope we can have it now. Thank you.
Okay, everyone, well, it's...